Now, this is continuing with Bertel Hoogland the following day at Bologna. Well, I think we'd covered pretty much up till 1960 or so. Would you agree with that, or did you think of anything more to say?
Well, we also have done radar astronomy, or rather meteor astronomy.
I see.
Yes. I suppose it was also Rydbeck who started this. This is a receiver at 32, 33, 34 megahertz, something like this. And it has really not been used by Onsala people at all. It's mainly Bertilander Lindblad in Lund Observatory. He is related to the Stockholm Lindblads, a bit distantly. And he has, I think, a continuous run of 18 or 19 years now that he has been studying the Perseus shower in August.
I see.
And so this is more of a sideline.
Where has this been published, and this sort of work?
Well, I don't know where it has appeared. Well, to begin with, he saw variations in echo numbers that he tried to fit into a model of space bunching, you know, along the orbit of the Perseus shower. He had a sausage model, he had a, well, I think a clump model or something like that too. Oh no, I think it was a kind of layers model. But finally it has turned out that this variation is just an effect in the Earth's atmosphere. Depends on the solar cycle. The ionosphere moves up and down.
As to how many echoes you get?
Yes, right.
I see.
Because the range changes where they disintegrate.
Right, right.
So, anyway, it's been a result, yeah. But
This is at Onsala, though?
This is at Onsala.
Receiver.
And we are not entirely happy, perhaps, to have it there now, because we fear it could interfere with our other observations. Although, I mean, we observed this year, for instance, with it, we could not really say that it caused any interference with us. So.
And it's only a few, a week, a year or so?
It's a week, a year or so, yes.
I got the impression from what you said yesterday that during the 50s, there wasn't a lot of scientific output from Onsala. It was much more of getting to know the techniques of radio.
Yes,
would you say
right.
It's a fair?
I should say so. There were some publications within the country, partly on eclipse results. I don't think we ever published in the international journals at that time. Not any radio astronomic results at any rate. And, well, even my 21 centimeter work was not published in the international journal. It was published in the proceedings of the Swedish Astronomical Society.
So what caused the changeover, would you say? I suppose it was the Big Dish.
Yes, that's right.
Does that come in at this point now, around 1960?
Yes, I think the planning started in 62 or so. The building was started in 1963. That's when I was in the U.S., so I don't know very much about it. But I'd say historically there were, the 21-meter telescope was one of the things. The other thing was the MESA development. It started
that's
in 1958 or 59. With development of MESA crystals and things like this.
What was the impetus for that? I mean, that was only when Townes was first sticking a MESA on the 50-foot at NRL.
I mean, Rydbeck has been quick on the trigger, you know, with many things like that. And I think he really understood the importance of the MESA. And it was against the advice of nearly everyone that he started this. And if you take it from the very first, it took us, say, 10 years before we had a MESA on the telescope.
Yeah. In the late 60s. Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
So, I mean, there were lab models working earlier
than
that,
to
but
put it.
I don't think we put them Mason on the telescope till 66 or 67.
And who was the person running this Maser show? Was it an inbred group entirely? Or?
An inbred group?
Yeah, I mean, no outside expert came in.
No, no, no.
Just learned it.
That's right. The people educated themselves as they went along. Well, Rydbeck knowing most of it to begin with. He had Ingvesson, Kjell Olof Ingvesson, whom you know.
Right. I don't know him personally, but I know of him.
And
well, now it's paying off.
Yes,
now you
that's
have
right.
the best receivers in the world.
Yes, still at the price of complexity. Having to fill it each day and things like this.
But I understand that it's not all that bad. I mean, it's not something we have to run up every 2 hours and retune something.
Not at all. But it is so that, there has been talk about selling Masers elsewhere, which is
I've heard some
possible.
Of that talk in Holland.
Yes, right. If we were just to sell one of our Maser packages abroad, I think the Maser would get a bad name.
I see.
Simply because it takes some expertise to run it.
Keep it running.
Yeah.
I see.
You just don't sell a Mason and let the people run it. It's,
you
need the backup organization.
Well, at least your Masers aren't to that point. I mean, presumably that could be done, but it would be another whole development.
Yes, that's right.
To
this
make it idiot-proof, so to speak.
Yeah.
Well, is there any other things that you think of about your stay in Sweden before you went to the States? What was going on there?
No, not very much. I think before I went to the US, I spent more than half my time on technical problems and the rest on scientific problems. All the reduction work was done by hand.
It was
a slow process.
So you went to NREO in 62, is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
And we're actually at Greenbank? Greenbank,
yes.
And what was the atmosphere at Greenbank like? It's only about 4 or 5 years old at that point.
Yes, well, to a newcomer there, it was a kind of established place. I heard, of course, from speaking with the people there and with outside people that Greenbank did not have a very good name to begin with, and because they felt they had got too much money and there had happened too little to begin with. But I think this is just the natural thing that happens. I mean, no one today would say anything about Greenbank that it's not giving its money's worth.
Right.
So, but I think people were to some extent influenced by this talking. I think they felt that they would have to excuse themselves.
Really? Was there any basis for these, as far, in your opinion?
No, not really. I think it was a kind of an upstart, after all, you know.
Yeah.
Because there were older groups in existence at the time,
right.
Working under university conditions with much less money, you know, and everything.
So perhaps there's a little bit of jealousy going on here also.
Yes, I should think so. But I'm not saying that this was something that was very distinct. It's sort of more a vague feeling you could get sometimes.
But it was affecting the morale somewhat at Greenbank, or?
Well, I don't know. I probably would not say that it was affecting the morale seriously.
Okay, well, then there was just an attitude then.
Yes, right.
So what was it, Greenbank in 62? Was it still only the 85 foot, the original?
85 to 300 had been completed shortly before I came there.
I see, it was finished also.
Yes. And, well, some smaller, the 40 foot was there.
That's right. And the horn, of course.
The horn was there, yes. Well, that's about it.
And what did you work on there?
Well, to begin with, on the 20-channel receiver, the filter receiver, it was for extragalactic work. It was, I think it was essentially Mort Rogers that was interested in this. And the work on the receiver had been started by Tule Horhaug, also from Sweden, who spent 2 years there before me. I sort of replaced him.
I see.
But then I also did observations there. I made a survey with a 300 foot. That was in 1964.
More specifically, what survey was it?
Oh, it was around declination. Well, it started off as a few scans, 24 hours of light ascension at 40 degrees declination. And then it proved, well, kind of successful. This was a kind of test survey only. And then I made a larger survey covering about 3 or 4 degrees around declination 20 degrees.
At what frequency?
At 7, 20 and 14, 10. And I had something like 3 months of observing time, 24 hours a day on 300 foot. It's not so easy to get today.
Well, this is not too bad on the 300 foot, but certainly it's not so easy. The 140 foot is, you know, much worse than 300 foot.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yeah.
Also at this time, the 140 foot was being constructed. And I haven't gotten to the right person yet for its problems, but do you know any about any of them?
Well, there were several million dollars worth of junk lying around the unfinished 140 foot when I got there.
And what,
it had been badly mismanaged somehow. I don't know the details. There are many people at NRAO who could tell you about this.
Who could?
Well, perhaps some who would.
That's my problem, perhaps. I haven't tried.
No. Well.
But what do you mean? These were pieces that had to be redesigned?
Yes. I heard some of the problems. I don't remember them all. But somehow the whole concept was, it had to be changed with the time.
Do you mean the mounting concept, the yoke and this sort of thing, or?
Yeah, or if it was just on the engineering side, the construction side. I'm not quite sure. I rather think I should try and stay out of speculations.
But yeah, sure, that doesn't do any good.
No.
But you weren't involved in it anyway.
I weren't, no.
Yeah.
But, I think they were perhaps to a large extent on the management side also. And, you know, they wanted to make it to make it a bit cheaper, they had limited sky coverage.
At first?
At first. Well, I think they still do. They can't reach the pole, can they? Well, there is some kind of limitation, I think. And it turns out that it would have cost 1 or 2% more of it all to get the full coverage.
I've never run into it.
Well, small things like that, yes. But I think there is a kind of limitation. But out of the $30 million that it costs, I guess half is just down the drain. For some reason or another. But after, it's been a highly successful telescope.
Yeah, since then.
So,
That's for sure.
It's paid for itself.
Yeah.
It could have been even cheaper.
Well, thank you very much. That finishes the interview with Hoogland on 29 September 1972 at Bologna.